The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am excited to introduce our author this evening. Alice McDermott has been coming to the Free Library for nearly 20 years, and there's a good reason we continue to invite her back. She's simply one of the best writers this country has to offer. I'm sure you are well aware of her books, awards, and achievements. If you're not, you'll find them in your program. If you are, you'll find them in your program. Tonight, by way of introduction, I'll just offer a brief section from yet another stellar review of Alice's latest novel, The Ninth Hour. This one is from the Washington Post, which calls the book superb and masterful, and then goes on to say, "There are so many ways to read this beautiful novel, as a Greek tragedy with its narrative chorus and the sins of the fathers, as a Faulknerian tale out to prove once more that the past is not even past, as a Gothic tale wrestling with faith, punishment, and redemption, a la Flannery O'Connor, or as an Irish novel in the tradition of Anne Enright and Colm Tóibín, whose sentences, like hers, burn on the page. But The Ninth Hour is also a love story, told at a languid and desultory pace, and fulfilled most satisfyingly at," well, you'll just have to read this one too. Please join me in welcoming Alice McDermott.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Andy. Thank you all for being here. Is this good? Great. Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be back here. I'm sort of having, remember the Groundhog Day movie? After five times, it's life doesn't go on. I just come to the Free Library. A kind of Shangri-La. What a pleasure to be here. I know there's a game tonight, right? Even in Washington, D.C., also known as Mudville, we know that things are going on in Philly that are no longer going on in Washington. I thought I'd talk just a little bit and read just a little bit, but most of all, I'm here to hear from you, to entertain your questions or comments, so I'll try not to take up too much time pontificating. I gave a reading at the Brooklyn Public Library a couple of weeks ago, and one of my dear cousins who lives on Long Island came with his wife, and I was so happy to see them in the audience, and we went out to dinner afterwards, and I wrote her an email when I got home, and I said, "Oh, thank you so much for sitting there and listening to me spout." And she wrote back, "Oh, no problem. We loved listening to you spout." And then her next line was, "We're nerds that way." So let me spout a little bit about The Ninth Hour. I think one of the questions that comes up, not to steal your thunder, more often than not, is where does a novel begin? What's the inspiration? As I've explained, it's different. It's different for every novel. It's different for every short story. Sometimes it's a character. Sometimes it's something you remember vaguely. Sometimes it's something you remember vividly. Sometimes it's something you've read in the news. The Ninth Hour began, oddly enough, with a conversation that I had over dinner and afterwards with a dear friend down in Washington, a Washington lawyer, but an amateur historian. This was some years ago, back when we had conversations in Washington that weren't about you-know-who. And he just happened to mention in the course of the conversation that he had a vague recollection from his own childhood. He grew up in upstate New York, way upstate New York, that An old man had lived in one of his aunt's or uncle's houses who had served as a substitute in the Civil War for one of his ancestors. And we talked a little bit about this idea that there was a time during the war between the states that a wealthy family or a wealthy young man could hire someone to go in his place. And I know I had heard about that before. I'm sure, you know, somewhere in my education, reading about the Civil War, there was some mention of that. I had a recollection of a novel, a wonderful historical novel called Banished Children of Eve by Peter Quinn, that a very thick novel, but the idea of substitutes being used, often immigrants, poor farmers would take the place of wealthier families. So I knew something about it. It wasn't as if it was news to me, but the notion stayed with me. I found myself reading about just what the permutations of the laws changed. Sometimes it was just a private deal. Then the federal government tried to codify it somehow. They said how much money you needed to pay someone to do it. It changed over the years of the war. I suppose if I myself were a historical novelist or even a historian, I might have been looking, as I read about this, for story, for an actual character who I could somehow illustrate or dramatize. But I'm not that kind of writer. What I found myself looking for was metaphor. The idea of someone who goes and puts his life at risk, perhaps even gives his life, so that someone else doesn't have to. I'm sure you're all thinking right away, well, that sounds like 21st century military. It's kind of a military of substitutes. Any of you who have lived through the Vietnam era and remember the draft, there was also something of that. The wealthy kids didn't go. The middle and working class kids went. I just heard John McCain, was it yesterday, referring to the unfairness of that in his own time during the Vietnam era when certain wealthy kids with bone spurs didn't have to go. I'm just quoting John. That whole notion of who chooses, who goes, who gets to stay, what life is more valuable than another. And then I started thinking, and then how long do you have to be grateful for the person who put himself in harm's way so that you could live? One generation? Two generations? If someone going in your place meant that you not only got to live, but you got to procreate, well, then the next generation is only alive because of that person who stood in harm's way. And the next generation is only alive because of the person who... is there a statute of limitations when you can just say it's been 300 years? Come on. So I started thinking about who goes, who stays, how much gratitude do you have to show, how much guilt is involved if someone dies or someone comes back damaged and your life goes on comfortably. How do you acknowledge that? And being born and bred Catholic, I can't help it, and thinking metaphorically about selflessness, sacrifice, one goes into harm's way so that others may live. Well, it wasn't long before I was up against he who died so that all may live. And then I thought, oh, damn, this is going to be a Catholic novel again. how do you get into that? And I found myself sort of writing, okay, maybe there's a character, a substitute, someone lingering, someone who would be known through story, perhaps. someone who went but came back so that he would be a presence, kind of a hovering presence, just as my friend had vaguely mentioned. He had that in his experience. So I was playing with that, but, you know, I'm not going to write a Civil War novel. I mean, my editor probably would have passed out if I had said to him, yeah, this is going to be a Civil War novel. But what can I do with this metaphorically? How can I develop this? Who's this character? One of the pieces of advice that I give to my students that I love giving because I love watching their faces. They'll bring a short story or a piece of a novel into my office to discuss it. And at one point I'll say to them, now be careful that your story isn't too much about what it's about. And they always go, oh, yeah. And then 5 seconds later, you can see them going, what the hell does that mean? It's either about it or it's not, right? Which then gets me to quote Emily Dickinson, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. So I thought, how do I get into this story about selflessness? Can you even write a novel about selflessness in the 21st century? Do we even value it? Do we even understand its ramifications? Is it actually something that is to be valued? Another thing that I know from being a teacher and being around undergrads and graduate students happens at least once every semester, if not multiple times. Some graduating senior or someone just finishing their MFA will come in and say to me, you know, I think I'm going to go to Teach for America, and I'm going to teach in some rural school for a couple of years. I said, that's great. I think maybe I'll see about joining the Peace Corps and teach literacy somewhere. That's great. Jesuit Volunteer Corps. Yes, great, wonderful. And they talk about their visions for what they can do and how grateful they are for their good education. And then always, at some point in the conversation, they'll say, and it will look really good on my resume. And I've sometimes toyed with the notion that I know their parents would not be happy with me if I proposed, but if I said to them, well, you know, for this really to be a generous act, you shouldn't tell anyone you've done it. You should just go away for 2 years and never mention it. Just do it for the selfless giving of yourself. Don't look for any reward. They would think I was nuts, and I wouldn't blame them. I mean, what? I'm going to throw away 2 years doing all this good, and nobody's going to know about it? So I don't know. Do we value it? Do we just find it sort of a foolish notion? If you've done good, you should be rewarded for it. So with that idea, I thought maybe the way into this novel is not directly into The Substitute, although I want that to be part of it. Maybe tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Don't let the story be too much about what it's about. If I'm going to write a novel that is essentially about selflessness, why don't I start with an act that is the complete opposite? So I thought about that for a while. And what would be the complete opposite of an action that says, nothing for me, all for you? And I thought, well, you know, an argument could be made, especially if you look at it in the right era, not the 21st century when we have a different understanding, but maybe back early in the 20th century, you could argue that suicide is the exact opposite. Because here's an act that says, I don't care about anybody else but myself. It's so much my life, only my life, that I can even take it. And that's when I started to understand that might be the way into the novel. So I had this 21st century ideas about selflessness, this echo of a past do we need to still be grateful? Do we even need to acknowledge it? How much guilt do we have to carry one generation after the other that this guy died or this guy got damaged and our progenitor didn't? And then the single act of complete selflessness, selfishness, not selflessness. So I'm going to read just two sections that sort of deal with both those things. And you will see that there's one, this isn't subtle. I'm not subtle. I don't know why people think I'm subtle. I'm not subtle. There's one place where these characters interconnect, where there's a brush in these two sections I'm going to read. And it's that brush that became the bulk of the novel. Unbeknownst to me early on, it became a novel about nuns. Oh my God. So here's just a bit of a chapter that takes place about page 70 in a very short novel called Rose. We had on our father's side a great, great Aunt Rose, a tiny woman, very old. We recall a velvet hat and a pale broadcloth suit, rose-colored, perhaps, and maybe the smell of rose water about her as she made her way into the house, one gloved hand steadying herself on the long server that had been our grandmother's, one skimming the backs of the chairs that lined the dining table, skimming our cheeks as well as she encountered us one by one. Our father behind her, carrying her bag, saying, "Step aside," telling us, "Say good afternoon, say pardon me." Our father, a doorman's son, banging her two suitcases against the chair legs and setting the porcelain in the china cabinet ringing. This was in the drafty house in Hempstead, where we grew up. It was an old house, red-shingled and white-trimmed, plagued with an endless series of tumble-down catastrophes that made our father in midlife a caricature of the hapless, city-bred, suburban homeowner. We recall him prowling through the rooms with a stepladder on his shoulder, with a hammer or a socket wrench in his hands, doing no good. Our mother, when she was well, always smiling indulgently, following him with her eyes. The old Hempstead house. We recall the battered glass knob of the side door, our shoulders to its peeling paint, a nest of boots and shoes inside, no matter the season, a tattered rag rug, the dark basement breath of heating oil and cinder block and cold dirt. Then three steps up to the narrow kitchen, dark green countertops, black linoleum floor flecked with red, red cabinets, appliances of enamel and steel, scent of clove and cinnamon and sunlight and dust. The narrow passage to the dining room, lace tablecloth, lace doilies, lace curtains at the window and beyond it, a continuation of lace, the apple tree in full wind-scattered bloom, or maybe a sudden shower of snow. As old Aunt Rose steadied herself coming into the house, one gloved hand on the long server that had been our grandmother's, one running along our cheeks. Just where she had come from and why she had appeared remained uncertain. Upstate, we were told. Because she is old, we were told. She was given the guest room and directed by our father, we followed her halting journey up the stairs with our hands poised at her elbows or at her hips. She trembled, we recall, either because of her great age or because of her delight at our elaborate courtesies. The guest room on the third floor of the old Hempstead house was narrow beneath the eaves, painted yellow, white curtains at the window. Downstairs again, our father told the story of Great Aunt Rose and Red Whelan. Up in Poughkeepsie, this was, he said, just after the Civil War. A knock at the door when the family was at dinner, Rose only a small child, a man invited in. Red hair, red skin, scarred red flesh from neck to ear as if a plow had scraped his face. One leg and one arm so that he, too, Red Whelan, made a halting climb to the upstairs room, tap of crutch on each stair tread on the attic's bare wood. Patrick, our great-grandfather, a young school teacher by then, standing silently in the room's narrow doorway as Red Whelan was shown the bed, the washstand, a small desk, and a wide-winged chair, all the family had done to prepare the place for him. The room where he would live out his days. And Great Aunt Rose, still a child, holding his dinner in a covered dish. When we were teenagers, brooding in our bedrooms, brooding or hungover or just sleeping through an afternoon, as our mother used to do, our father would complain, his voice annoyed, bordering on angry, but amused also because he, too, had been a reader, a brooder, and the phrase had been his own father's refrain, hibernating up there like Red Whelan. Any red-headed, fat-faced, freckled Irishman was a regular Red Whelan. Any house guest who stayed too long was threatening to become a Red Whelan. Any mention of old Aunt Rose's long and lonely life included the 40-odd years she had devoted herself to Red Whelan, her brother's substitute in the Civil War. A widowed spinster, our father called her, a married nun. We carried the tea things upstairs. We carried her sparse dinner, only small bowls of mush, soups and applesauce and cream farina. In the third floor room, she blinked at us from her bed or from her chair, her face always dusted with powder, although it seemed to us then that she was dusted with dust. And the little nursing sisters of the sick poor standing by. "Aren't you good?" they told us when we brought in the old lady's tray or took it away. Sister Jean, among them, our favorite. We knew them well, the little nursing sisters, the order of nuns our mother had thought to join until, our father liked to say, she thought better of it. We knew them from our own fevered mornings, waking to find their pale hands to our foreheads and to our cheeks, or seeing through our crusted eyes their serious faces within the white bonnets as they put a thermometer between our lips, commanded us not to bite it. We watched them float around our sick beds, tugging and pulling with their short, clean hands until our night-tangled blankets and sheets were transformed into something clean again and cool. We knew them from all the long afternoons when we came home from school, hand to the glass knob of the battered side door, and found a nursing nun standing like a black and white beacon in the kitchen, her finger to her lips because our mother had once more taken to her shaded room to sleep off what they called her melancholy. They arrived by taxi in those days, before their habits were amended to allow them enough peripheral vision to drive themselves. Our father scurried out to the curb to pay the fare. For years, we believed we were not unusual in this. For years, we believed the little nursing sisters of the sick poor, congregation of Mary before the cross, appeared in every household whenever crisis or illness disrupted the routine, whenever a substitute was needed for she who could not be replaced. So that's how I got my substitute worked into the novel. But here's how the novel opens. In a chapter called These Short Dark Days. February 3rd was a dark and dank day altogether, cold, spitting rain in the morning and a low, steel-gray sky the rest of the afternoon. At 4, Jim convinced his wife to go out to do her shopping before full darkness fell. He closed the door on her with a gentle wave. His hair was thinning and he was missing a canine on the right side, but he was nevertheless a handsome man who, at 32, might still have passed for 20. Heavy brows and deep-set, dark-lashed eyes that had been making women catch their breath since he was 16. Even if he had grown bald and toothless, as he seemed fated to do, the eyes would have served him long into old age. His overcoat was on the hall tree beside the door. He lifted it and rolled it lengthwise against his thighs. Then he fitted it over the threshold, tucking the cloth of the sleeves and the hem as well as he could into the space beneath the door. Theirs was a railroad flat, kitchen in the back, dining room, living room, bedroom in the front. He needed only to push the heavy couch a few feet farther along the wall to block his wife's return. He stood on the seat to check that the glass transom above the door was tightly closed. Then he stepped down. He straightened the lace on the back of the couch and brushed away the shallow impression his foot had made on the horsehair cushion. In the kitchen, he pressed his cheek to the cold enamel of the stove and slid his hand into the tight space between it and the yellow wall. He groped a bit. They kept a baited mousetrap back there, or had in the past, and it made him careful. He found the rubber hose that connected the oven to the gas tap and pulled at it as vigorously as he could, given the confined space. There was a satisfying pop and a hiss that quickly faded. He straightened up with the hose in his hand. The kitchen window looked into the gray courtyard where, on better days, there would be lines of clothes baking in the sun, although the floor of the deep courtyard, even in the prettiest weather, was a junkyard and a jungle. There were rats and bedsprings and broken crates, a tangle of city-bred vegetation, a sickly tree, black vines, a long-abandoned attempt at a garden. From rag and bone man to wayward drunk, any voice that ever rose out of its depths was the voice of someone up to no good. Once, Annie, his wife, sitting on the windowsill with a clothespin in her mouth and a basket of wet linen at her feet, saw a man drag a small child through the muck and tie him to the rough pole that held the line. She watched the man take off his belt, and with the first crack of it against the child's bare calves, she began to yell. She threw the clothespins at him, a potted ivy plant, and then the metal wash basin still filled with soapy water. Leaning halfway out the window herself, she threatened to call the police, the fire department, the Garrity Society. The man, as if pursued only by a change in the weather, a sudden rain, glanced up briefly, shrugged, and then untied the sobbing child and dragged him away. "I know who you are," Annie cried, although she didn't. She was an easy liar. She paced the street for an hour that afternoon, waiting for the man and the boy to reappear. When Jim ran into the kitchen at the sound of her shouting, she was from head to waist out the window with only one toe on the kitchen floor. He had had to put his hands on her hips to ease her out of danger. Just one more of what had turned out to be too many days he hadn't gone into work or had arrived too late for his shift. His trouble was with time. Bad luck for a train man, even on the BRT. His trouble was He liked to refuse time. He delighted in refusing it. He would come to the end of a long night, to the inevitability of 5 a.m., that boundary, that abrupt wall towards which all the night's pleasures ran, drink, talk, sleep, or Annie's warm flesh. And while other men, poor sheep, gave in every morning, turned like lambs in the chute from the pleasures of sleep or drink or talk or love to the duties of the day, he had been aware since his childhood that with the easiest refusal, eyes shut, he could continue as he willed. "I'm not going," he would only have to murmur. "I won't be constrained." Of course, it didn't always require refusing the whole day. Sometimes just the pleasure of being an hour or two late was enough to remind him that he, at least, was his own man, that the hours of his life, and what more precious commodity did he own, belonged to himself alone. 2 weeks ago, they had discharged him for unreliability and insubordination. Inside the shell of his flesh, the man he was, not the blushing, humiliated boy who stood ham-handed before them, simply shook off the blow and turned away, indifferent, free. But Annie wept when he told her, and then said angrily through her tears that there was a baby coming, knowing even as she said it that to break the news to him in this way was to condemn the child to a life of trouble. He took the tea towels she had left to dry on the sink, wound them into ropes, and placed them along the sill of the kitchen window. He carried the length of rubber tubing through the living room and into the bedroom. He slipped off his shoes, put the tube to his mouth as if to pull smoke. He had seen this in a picture book back home, a fat sultan on a red pillow doing much the same. He sat on the edge of the bed. He bowed his head and prayed, "Now and at the hour of our death." He lay back on the bed. The room had gotten dimmer still. Hour of hour. Hour, hour. At home, his mother, the picture book spread out on her wide lap, would reach behind him to turn the clock face to the wall. Within this very hour, he would put his head on her shoulder once again. Or would he? There were moments when his faith fell out from under him like a trap door. He stood up, found his nightshirt underneath his pillow and twisted it too, then placed it along the edge of the one window, again pushing the material into the narrow crevice where the frame met the sill, knowing all the while that the gesture was both ineffectual and unnecessary. Down in the street, there was a good deal of movement. Women, mostly, because the shops were open late and the office workers had not yet begun to file home. Dark coats and hats, a baby buggy or two, the wheels turning up a pale spray. He watched two nuns in black cloaks and white wimples, their heads bent together, skim over the gray sidewalk. He watched until they were gone, his cheek now pressed to the cool window glass. When he turned back into the room, the light had failed in every corner, and he had to put out his hand as he walked around the pale bed, back to his own side. He stretched out once again, playfully lifted the hose to one eye, as if he would see along its length the black corridor of a subway tunnel, lit gold at the farthest end by the station ahead. Then he placed the hose in his mouth and breathed deeply once more. He felt the nausea, the sudden vertigo he had been expecting all along but had forgotten he was expecting. He closed his eyes and swallowed. Outside, a mother called to a child. There was the slow clopping of a horse-drawn cart, the feathered sound of wheels turning in street water, Something dropped to the floor in the apartment just above him, a sewing basket, perhaps. There was a thud, and then a scratchy chorus of wooden spools spinning. Or maybe it was coins spilled from a fallen purse. At six, the street lamps against the wet dark gave a polish to the air. There was the polish of lamplight, too, on streetcar tracks and window panes and across the gleaming surface of the scattered black puddles in the street. Reflection of lamplight as well on the rump of the remaining fire truck and on the pale faces of the gathered crowd, with an extra gold sparkle and glint on anyone among them who wore glasses. Sister Saint Savior, for instance, a little nursing sister of the sick poor, who had spent the afternoon in the vestibule of the Woolworths at Borough Hall, her alms basket in her lap. She was now on her way back to the convent, her bladder full, her ankles swollen, her round glasses turned toward the lamplight, and the terrible scent of doused fire on the winter air. So the nuns.
Before we invite the audience, we were talking backstage a bit before about the title, and I'd asked you if the ninth hour was somehow a play on none, and if you could elaborate on that.
Sure. The title, The Ninth Hour, is refers to, in the Divine Hours, the Liturgy of the Hours, it's about 3 o'clock, the series of hours of prayers at specified time. In the Old Testament, it was the time of sacrifice. In the New Testament, because God, or whoever wrote the Bible, is an exquisite artist, it's the time that Christ dies on the cross. You know, once you set up a metaphor in the Old Testament, you gotta pick it up again in the New Testament. I wanted originally to call the book The Hour of None, N-O-N-E, which would be the Latin for ninth hour. I just loved the way it looked on the page. I just loved it. I had been reading, while I was writing this book, W.H. Auden's wonderful series, Ore Canonica, which is about, which has a poem for each of the hours of prayer, and he has nones in his ninth hour. But I realized that, number one, we're not all up on our Latin. And so for a lot of readers, they would see the hour of N-O-N-E and read it as none. Why not? And I sort of, that was another thing I liked about it. None, no one, ordinary people, no, you know, my last book was someone, this could be kind of a play, I don't know. But I was afraid that it would ultimately be read as a pun on none. and then it just got too complicated. So sometimes our intentions and our language don't always meet up. So I figured the ninth hour would be safe and not open to mispronunciation.
Yeah, I was just wondering what your writing process is. How long does it take you to write a book? Do you write every day? Do you take time off? Just what's your method?
Sure, thank you. So I do write every day, except when I'm on book tour. Another thing I tell my students is the worst thing you can do for your writing is publish. They don't buy that either. I learned really early on that if I didn't treat this crazy profession as if it were a real job, no one else around me would. Even now, 8 books on, friends I've known since high school and college will call me in the middle of the day and say, "Are you busy?" And I'll say, "I'm writing." And they'll say, "Oh, good, because I have to tell you this." You know, you're just making this stuff up, and you don't have a boss, and you can do it whenever. But you know, I'm middle class enough to know that if I didn't treat it as if it were a real job, it would never get done. So I've always, I teach one day a week. The other 4 days during the week are writing days in normal times. I try to be at my desk at 9 o'clock. When my kids were at home, 3 o'clock, it had to stop. Now I go to 6 or 7, depending on how hungry I get or how much in need of a glass of wine I become. But I think being there is the most essential thing. Doesn't mean that you're writing every day. You may be writing, you may not be writing very well. Sometimes it's just going over. I do try to rewrite everything I've written the day before at the beginning of every day, and then add a little, and then rewrite that, and then add a little. So for me, it's fiction by accrual. I know there are some writers who say that, you know, they print out their first drafts on blue paper, and then their second drafts on yellow paper, and then their final drafts on pink paper, which I admire tremendously. I never know what draft I'm on. It's just that slow accrual to teach myself what the novel is about. Right.
Both those characters, Red and Jim, are male.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself equally intrigued in your novel by women. Can you speak a little bit? My sense is that Sister Lucy and Sally are both caught at times in a sense of powerlessness, a lack of freedom. Can you talk a little about women a little bit?
Sure. Well, I'm glad to hear that because, except for those brief appearances, it's all women all the time in this novel. it really is. The novel does follow Annie, who's the pregnant widow of the suicide, and not only Sister Saint Savior, who comes in and sort of takes over for her. Annie's child, other nuns. I learned if you let one strong nun into your novel, the door is open. They're just going to keep coming. That was not my original intention. As a matter of fact, I killed Sister, not to give anything away, I killed Sister Saint Savior off at the end of the first chapter thinking, I don't want to write a book about nuns, but I already had these other two lingering, and they had something to say, and then they gave Annie a job in the convent, which was a great thing for a single woman at this time and place with very little social safety net. So it really became a book about these women and the nuns and the work they do. The sense of the variety of who these women are, even though they're all wearing the same clothes, the pride they take in their daily labor. Sister Illuminata is the laundress who has a PhD in laundry. She knows laundry like nobody else, and she can iron with expertise that there should be a Nobel Prize for. So it very much became a novel about these women. And in some ways, again, you're always looking for the metaphor, it became about the underground work that they do. I mean, literally, the laundry is in the basement of the convent. But also the work that they do in the neighborhood, going into homes, taking care often of other women, women with children, older women. The nursing sisters at this time, and this is my own order of nuns. I had to found my own order. It's great fun. But it's an amalgam of many orders that I read about while I was researching. The work they did was absolutely astounding. Everything from, seeing someone through their last days, delivering babies, taking care of the children, if the mother was ill, or if the mother had to go off and take care of somebody else, buying groceries, cleaning the house, washing their clothes, washing their bed linen. These women did remarkable things. Just kind of keeping life going for the poor with very little acknowledgement, not only from the men in this novel, but historically from the men who were in charge. So this is very much, I mean, the men are, and I don't do that, I've never consciously make a character peripheral. I think every character, if it's going to be on the page, if you're going to be the creator of this character, you have to give that character the benefit of his or her full humanity. So it never occurred to me, and some people have brought this up, but it never occurred to me that I'm getting back at some of the male writers who wrote cliched and shallow, as much as I might love their work, but who could never write a woman. I'm sure we can all think about some wonderful older male writers who have never been able to write a believable woman. I would never create a character just to get back, you know. But this became the woman's world, and the men were indeed peripheral to it because they were off doing other things.
So many times you hear an author say they don't know what they're going to be writing about. They sit down and start and they wait for their, I don't know, kind of to begin, or see where the characters take them or who appears on the page. Those of us who are not novelists, that's kind of hard to understand.
I agree.
So I'm wondering, when you start, do you know, does it happen? What would you say about how the novel evolves in your own life?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's a wonderful question. There's a way that novelists, and I count myself one of them often, can make this sound much more mysterious than it really is. For me, it again, everything's different. Every story starts differently, but it's a notion about a character, an incident, or again, something you're trying to wrap your head around: selflessness, generational obligations. But all that, in some ways, has to be put aside because the sentences come first, you know, And when I approach, even with all those things in mind, I put them aside. And the thing that I take most to heart from the very beginning is Joseph Conrad's wonderful injunction to fiction writers that above all, you must make us see. Put us there. And that involves the careful use of language. That involves a certain rhythm to the sentences, not just the words you choose or the tense you decide or the first person or third person, all those things. It's about rhythm, it's about music, that kind of inner music of language. And this is where we get kind of weird, you know. But I do believe, and I've been teaching long enough and I've seen it happen with other writers, young or inexperienced writers, not necessarily young, and not always inexperienced, but I've seen it with other writers. If you think about our language, if you think about those of us who are writing in our first language, how did we achieve that language, fluency in that language? No parents throw textbooks and language tapes into a crib and say to the kid, you know, once you got that, I'll come back and talk to you. You know, we attain our first language through experience. We hear others speaking. Our parents, the people who take care of us, the people who are around us, the people in the larger world, community, storytelling at the dinner table, storytelling in church or temple, storytelling on the street, all shapes our language. So when you start working with language, when you're down in, I want to get this sentence right, I want to make it clear, I want to make it vivid, I want to want it to have its own rhythm or music, what you're doing is evoking all your own experience and everything you've ever read. And through that, I think that's a way that you tap into an unconscious that only language can elicit. And that's where the story starts to reveal itself to you, the one you didn't know you knew. And I think it's through just being in there and working. I, you know, painters talk about that, just having the paint. Sculptors talk, you got to get your hands into the material. I think for writers, it's language. Even if you think you know what you're going to say when you start, as soon as you start shaping the language, associations, unconscious, subconscious, memories, experiences, something you heard this morning, something you heard last night, all comes into the mix. And before you know it, you're surprising yourself with the details that you're choosing. So, yeah, it is kind of weird.
Thank you for this beautiful book. The minute I finished it, I rushed to the library, got out Charming Billy.
Oh, thank you.
You mentioned your students a couple of times, and I'm wondering whether you can put your finger on any sort of generalizable changes that you've observed in students over the years. Students who are dealing with the changes in our world and the changes in the way information comes to them, etc.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, some of the changes I think are shallow. You know, a sense of what are we talking about in the greater world, and should that be in my fiction? But I think I'm heartened to find that, you know, for the 2+ decades that I've been teaching, there's not a big difference. You know, my students, undergrad and grad, like, are bright, bright, bright kids. I know because I see their scores, you know. I know they could do anything. They could go to law school, they could go to medical school, they could get MBAs. They are very smart and very talented. And something is there that tells them this is what they want to do. They've fallen in love with a writer, they've fallen in love with a novel, they've fallen in love with short stories. God help them, some of them even want to be poets, you know. Oh my gosh. Oh, you know, the parents thought you were going to be pre-med. You know? But you fell in love. You know, and what they want to do, you know, what they want to somehow define what it is to be human. That's the broad goal. And sometimes it's through, you know, what they saw when they lived in Brooklyn. Sometimes it's through what happened to their parents. Or, you know, there's all kinds of approaches to it. But when you come right down to it, they love language, they love story, and they have this generosity. We're all in this together, and let me just tell a story that might get you thinking. You know, and some of them are funnier than others, and some of them are more ironic than others. There's all kinds of those kinds of phases. But the thing that brings them to this is always their readers who, Thomas Lynch says this, so I'll steal it from him because it's so great, who are drawn to do a little bit of karaoke, you know. They love it, they want to try it, they want to add their voice to it. And I don't think I'm being Pollyanna about that. I think there is that that steady, despite how shallow millennials are supposed to be, or how nobody's supposed to be reading, or that it was Harry Potter that got them to want to be writers in the first place. That's okay, I forgive them. It doesn't have to be Ernest Hemingway as it was 20 years ago. The drive, the fire to say something.
It's Let's wonderful. End it on a positive note. Please join me in thanking Alice McDermott. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.